What happens when we talk honestly about racism in America?
So I decided to write this letter called Dear White America, and I wanted it to be honest. I wanted it to speak to the hearts of white people. So I wanted them to really consider this as a personal letter of love. The article came out actually on Christmas Eve, and then, of course, Christmas morning happened, and it was at that moment that I began to receive a great deal of hate mail.
That's George Yancey. We spend the hour talking with him about racism in America and what white folks can do about it. His book is Backlash. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The holidays are just around the corner, a time when families and friends get together. What will you talk about around the Thanksgiving or holiday table? Here's a suggestion, at least for my white listeners, an honest and open-minded inquiry about racism and white privilege. It's a conversation that's long overdue, and it's something that every white person can do with the people in their lives to bring greater peace and joy at a time when the country seems on the brink of a cultural civil war. That was the intent behind my guest George Yancey's 2015 op-ed in the New York Times, Dear White America. It was written in a spirit of loving confrontation, akin to the intervention you might make with a loved one who has a substance abuse problem. Only here, the substance abuse is the pernicious seduction of white privilege, a privilege that depends on the dehumanization of others. Yancey knew his article would be controversial, but even he was shocked with the tsunami of racist invective he received, and 3 years later continues to receive, in response to his letter to white America. In his book Backlash, Yancey expands on the original article and chronicles the ensuing controversy as he seeks to understand what it was about the op-ed that created so much rage among so many white readers. He challenges white Americans to rise above the vitriol and to develop a new empathy for the African-American experience. He just recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times asking men to take responsibility for their role in the problem of violence against women. It's entitled #IAmSexist. Dr. George Yancey is an American philosopher and professor of philosophy at Emory University. He's also the editor for the Philosophy of Race book series of Lexington Books. He's known for his work in critical race theory, critical whiteness studies, and African-American philosophy. He's written, edited, or co-edited more than 18 books. The foreword to his book Backlash is written by Cornel West. Dr. George Yancey, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This book, Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America, I think is such an important book. And it came out of a letter that you wrote, Dear White America, that was published in the New York Times in 2015. Talk about what moved you to write that letter, and then tell us what you experienced as a result.
Yeah, sure. So what happened was I was actually reading interviews that were done by a philosopher named Gary Gutting, who was doing a series of interviews with philosophers who engage in the area of philosophy of religion. And it was a great series of interviews. And it occurred to me, well, I would love to interview a group of philosophers on the subject of race and racism. So I spoke to the two editors there at the Stone in New York Times, and both of them were very excited about the idea. And so I began doing these interviews. Eventually, it led to about 19 interviews. So I interviewed people like Noam Chomsky, Judith Butler, Malathi Asante, bell hooks, right? It was a wonderful critical cadre of public intellectuals and philosophers, and we talked about race. Well, at the end of philosopher Gary Gutting's interviews, he decided to interview himself, and I thought that was a pretty creative thing to do, but I thought, no, I'm not going to interview myself. I thought I needed to explore in greater detail the question of whiteness and what whiteness means in this country. And so I decided to write this letter called Dear White America. And I called it Dear White America because I wanted it to be very intimate. I wanted it to be honest. I wanted it to speak to the hearts of white people. So I wanted them to really consider this as a personal letter of love. In fact, I say that in the piece. So the article came out on Christmas Eve of all days. And then, of course, Christmas morning happened. And it was at that moment that I began to receive a great deal of hate mail. Now, what's ironic about this is that the letter was written out of a sense of love. And by love, I meant that sense in which James Baldwin talks about love, where he says, love removes the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live with. Or the way in which cultural theorist Bell Hooks talks about love, where she said, love is telling the truth to ourselves and sharing it with others. So there was this way in which I was conceiving the letter as really an act of love, right? A way of making myself vulnerable to white readers of the letter. And one way in which I made myself vulnerable was to talk about my own sexism, the way in which I continue to perpetuate sexism despite my best intentions. So the way in which I not only have accumulated and the ways in which I've become inculcated by and with racist assumptions and racist images, in fact, pornographic images of women, but also the way in which I am part of a patriarchal system in which my advantage means their disadvantage, my privilege means their lack of privilege or their oppression. So I thought that that would create a potential bridge for white people. It would reflect for them a way in which they too could be vulnerable about their whiteness, about their white privilege. Well, it turns out that that bridge collapsed, that immediately after this piece was published on Christmas morning, I received hate mail, particularly in the form of voice messages sent to my university my university answering machine. Eventually, I got postcards that were sent to me, letters that were sent to me, white supremacist groups and websites, quote-unquote, discuss the piece. I would get hundreds and hundreds of email messages, the majority of which, in fact, the vast majority of which, were consisted of calling me the N-word. In fact, I've not been called the N-word in my life as many times as I've been called. So many times, it's very nauseating and has an incredible physiological impact on one's body. There were times when people would write to me, white people, and say, let's put a meat hook in Yancey, lovingly, let's put a meat hook in him. There were others who said I should commit suicide right away, right? So that's what it was. That was the backlash to writing this incredible letter I thought was a letter of love.
Yeah, and you reproduce a lot of those letters in the book. I have to say it was, and you know, I'm white, and it was sickening for me to read them, and you just refer to the fact that there's a physiological reaction to you. I wonder if you could describe for us what is that traumatizing impact of you reading those letters, of you having the full force of that hatred directed at you?
Absolutely. You know, Richard Wright, the literary figure Richard Wright, in his book Black Boy, he talks about the fact that he had not experienced a lynching in the sense that, one, he was not a victim of a lynching, and yet not personally experienced one. But because of the white supremacist hatred that he had felt in the South, Jim Crow South, he said that it felt like a million lynchings. It felt that he himself had undergone these. And so in a way, my experience was analogous. You know, it's one thing to know about the history of white supremacy in America. It's another game altogether, as it were, to be the target of it. And so what happened was, I think as I read more of the really, I mean, they all were vitriolic, but when you have someone calling you by the N-word, when you have someone referring to you as a hood rat or as a monkey or an ape, and what they want to do with meat hooks and how they want to behead you ISIS style, you know, all this vitriolic violence, the language itself begins to perform an act. It's as if the language is in fact doing the work of a fist or the work of a rope around my neck. And I think that what happened is I didn't anticipate the full backlash. I mean, I knew I would get some folk who were not comfortable. I knew that, that white people would not be comfortable. But I didn't know that that the letter would elicit or provoke, or whatever term you want to use, this kind of really nasty white racist supremacy, and it's in terms of its imagery, in terms of its language. And so when I say that it had this impact on me physiologically, I mean that I had not even realized that when I was here, you know, at my home, being the father and husband that I am, I'd become short with my children, right, and with my significant other. My, you know, there was a feelings of trepidation, looking around, you know, looking over my shoulder in ways that I wouldn't normally do. It was as if my body was undergoing the trauma of having been hit, like, with a brick, right? That's what it was like. Because language, we often don't think that language has the power to do this, but language has the capacity, especially when it's said over and over and over again, and within such a relatively short period of time. Of course, I still receive hate mail. But to get mail also sent to me, for a white person to write a letter, put it in an envelope, and put a stamp on it, and to actually, you know, make the effort of going out to mail it, just to call me horrible names, is telling, right? And so it was something about hearing it. I think the most powerful was hearing it. You know, when I would play it, because my system at school is set up to actually record those messages, and actually to translate them, but also the ones that recorded. I think it was something about hearing, because you just don't hear words. You hear the emotional hatred. You hear the loudness of the voice. You hear the nervousness of the voice. You hear the absolute fanaticism of the voices that are calling you by the N-word. You know, and there's something about that that was very traumatic.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with philosopher George Yancey about his book, Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. You know, it's so easy for white people to hear what you're saying and say, well, that's not me. I would say your book is addressed more to the garden variety white person, not the white supremacist so much.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, this is where it's very instructive what you said about admitting that you are a sexist.
Mm.
You know, I'm obviously a woman, so I could really take in what you said. I'm going to read something that you wrote in this book, Backlash, George Yancey. You wrote, you said that by admitting that you are a sexist, your objective was not to propitiate women, but to take ownership of your sexism and male privilege, even as it is complicated by race, and to make a difference in terms of how you treat women and trouble the systemic structure of patriarchy. So now connect that to what you are asking white people. What was this address of love? What was the plea that was contained within it?
Yeah, excellent. So absolutely. So that's what I was trying to do. I think that was the plea. That was the invitation to become vulnerable, right? So the idea was that, look, I know that I'm not Harvey Weinstein. I'm not Bill Cosby, right? I have not engaged in acts of sexual assault against women. But that doesn't free me from the ways in which I continue to be a part of a culture that is predicated on male supremacy, that's predicated on misogyny, that's predicated on a pornographic culture that fragments women's bodies. And I'm also a participant precisely in that way of objectifying women, because I'm part of that male patriarchal culture, right, that thrives on a certain kind of misogyny. Again, that doesn't exempt me. So So I wanted to complicate that by saying, speaking to other men, said, look, I mean, I understand you consider yourself to be a good man. In fact, you might be a married man, but to be a married man does not exempt one from sexism. It just doesn't, because there's all kinds of ways in which we can bring our very rigid gender roles into those relationships. So I wanted to use that as a model to think about whiteness and racism vis-a-vis white people. So the idea was to communicate to white folk who know that they're not part of the Klan, who know that they're not neo-Nazis, in fact, who know that they've never used the N-word in their lives, who have never owned black people as slaves. I got that part. But that creates for me a false distinction between the bad white and the good white. Now, does that mean that I think that all white people are bad? Of course not. But what it does, what the good white, bad white distinction does, it allows white people to say something like, you see, that's racism, pointing to, let's say, the Klan, or pointing to what happened in Charlottesville. That's real racism. And I want to challenge that distinction by getting everyday white people who know that they're good human beings to begin to rethink the ways in which they harbor racist sensibilities, racist affects, racist ideas, and the ways in which they're part of a system that privileges them. Let's say when I walk into a store and a white man walks into the store at the same time that I do, and I'm followed by the white security guard, it's easy to say that the white security guard is the one who is racist. But my argument was that even the white male who gets to shop is also participating and benefiting from that racist system, because he goes into the store to shop and he's granted a certain kind of innocence, whereas I'm granted criminality. But you see, his innocence is predicated on my being deemed the criminal or the one who's going to steal, despite the fact that statistically white people on average will in fact shoplift more than black people or people of color. But you see, that's what I want to do. I want to break down the distinction between good and bad whites, where that distinction allows good whites off to get off the proverbial hook by simply saying, you see, I'm not part of the Klan. And you see, so what I argued, there's a point there in the book where I talk about Anderson Cooper, you know, at CNN, who has on his show Black Pundits. I remember during, you know, the discussion about Charlottesville, I would see this over and over where, you know, it'd be black and white pundits, all of whom would agree that what happened in Charlottesville was horrible, horrendous. And we all agree, I think, right? But what I found is that at no point would Anderson Cooper raise the question about his own privilege as a white male and what that white privilege means on an everyday level in terms of the ways in which he's able to negotiate the world with that white privilege in ways that his, let's say, his pundits of color are not able to negotiate. So that when we're talking about Charlottesville, I want whites who know what racism looks like in the form of the KKK to rethink the ways in which they too perpetuate racism. That's a much more complicated and more robust understanding of racism. But just as I too disidentify with a Harvey Weinstein, I at the same time identify with the structure of sexism.
Yeah, and what you just said about that whites are more likely to shoplift, well, that's part of white privilege too, because they know they can get away with it.
Absolutely.
In a way that a black person couldn't. I mean, it could put a black person at risk for their life. And there's a parallel to it all the way to the presidency, because you also point out the book, and this is certainly something I've seen for a while. I mean, Trump can say the most vile, racist, ignorant, outrageous things. But remember Obama. Obama had to be no drama Obama. Obama was criticized as being a racist when he dared to say that Trayvon Martin could have been his son, or that, you know, Henry Louis Gates, you know, invited him for a beer, or even any time he noticed white racism, he was accused of being a racist.
Yep. No, absolutely. And so, look, I think, and there I almost become speechless when I think about that, when I think about the fact that, and by the way, and keep in mind that many of many of the black intellectuals, I mean, Cornel West, for example, or Michael Eric Dyson and many others, were very critical of Obama in terms of his failure to really talk about race. So technically, when one tries to refer to Obama as a racist, he didn't really, quite frankly, say a great deal about race. Right? He was trying to be center there. And so you're right, that moment where he is saying, making this very personal statement about that I could have been Trayvon Martin, or if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin. And these are called acts of racism, when in fact what they are forms of identification and forms of trying to get a world to understand that to be black in America, there's a way in which one is already marked for death. Right? There's a way in which that black body is already prejudged as criminal. But yet, when we have someone like Trump, who says, you know, of Maxine Waters that she has this low IQ, as an IQ of 60, or Omarosa referring to her as a dog, or using the S-hole countries, which I won't say, or being very ambiguous, to say the least, about calling Charlottesville what it was by recognizing good people on both sides. I mean, what we've got here is racism at its best, and yet the problem is that white privilege allows Trump to be an individual male who says the things that he says. Whereas if Obama were to say something, it would not only reflect on Obama, it would reflect on all black people. So there's a privilege that white people have. They have the privilege not to be in a position to speak on behalf of their entire group, but they also have the privilege of being neoliberal subjects such that they can be these individuals and make the mistakes that they make. But yet, it doesn't reflect the entire group, but nor does it reflect on the individual's race. So when we critique Trump, for example, we critique the man Trump. We don't say, you see how profoundly immoral and ethically inept this white man happens to be, right? So he's got that privilege. He's not only got the privilege to obfuscate obvious, blatant forms of racism, but also he will never be called in this sense, publicly in some sense, in terms of his whiteness.
Right. And, you know, I also was struck by your use of the phrase, George Yancey, in Backlash. You use a phrase that I have often thought in myself, a culture, we live in a culture of cruelty and the discourse of humiliation. Of course, you know, we can say, well, the internet has made that worse, but it has ever been so. It is perhaps most intense as it's trained on black people, or maybe most historically long lasting. But in other parts of the country, Native Americans come for it. Immigrants are certainly the subjects of it. Women are certainly the subjects of the culture of cruelty and discourse of humiliation. It seems to be a systemic, foundational part of our society. Do you have, as a philosopher, from whence does this come?
Yeah, I think that we can't tell, to explain that, we can't tell a single narrative. In other words, while I would want to talk about whiteness as a structure and its relationship to, let's say, Native Americans, who were pretty much decimated during the founding of this country, they were not enslaved, right, whereas black people were. So there's a way in which this culture of cruelty, this culture of cruelty, this discourse of cruelty and humiliation, while it plays itself out in terms of transgender individuals, individuals who are gay, individuals who are queer, individuals who are poor, individuals who are immigrants. I mean, it plays itself out this way, and we have to give an explanatory account that links it with a certain kind of narrative. I can say this, that when we think about the history of white supremacy and we think about the history of whiteness as a structure, the structure itself is binary. So as a philosopher, I've come to this conclusion. When I say as a philosopher, I mean to think about these ideas with some depth and some intensity. Whiteness itself is a binary structure. And that means that whiteness is predicated on the other. So it needs the other in order to thrive. It needs a host. And in this case, in the history of of America, white America, it is the black body that is the host, and it's the whiteness that is the parasite, if you will. So as a binary structure, when black people are put down, that raises white people in terms of both ontologically, and by ontologically I mean in terms of their being, epistemologically, which means in terms of their intelligence, in terms of their knowledge, aesthetically, they become more beautiful as we are deemed the most ugly sub-persons that have ever existed. So there are ways in which the discourse of cruelty and acts of cruelty against the black body becomes forms of scaffolding white identity to unknown heights. So too, living within a discursive context of cruelty against women, we as men benefit from that cruelty, right? So if you want to know, if you want to know what cruelty looks like in a male supremacist society, you don't ask men. You ask the targets of that supremacy. You ask women. If you want to know what it means to be oppressed racially in terms of whiteness, you ask people of color. You ask brown people or red people or yellow people, using those old racial terms, right? You ask people of Asian descent or Native American or people who are Latino or Latinx. You don't ask white people because they're not undergoing that kind of cruelty. So I'm not arguing as a philosopher that we are somehow as human beings intrinsically evil. It's not clear to me. I put it this way. The jury is out for me in terms of the question as to whether human beings are intrinsically angelic, divine-like creatures or whether we are evil to our core. But I do know this, that the systems that are in place, call it sexism, call it patriarchy, call it xenophobia, call it heterosexism, call it racism, that all of these structures are predicated on the dehumanization and on the relegation of those human beings to lower levels. And it's that parasitic notion, it's the ways in which those structures of power are given strength through that denigration, I think, that we need to look at.
George Yancey. His book is Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with philosopher George Yancey talking about his book Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. Just before the break, Yancey was talking about the systemic structures of power that dehumanize certain groups of people, black people, women, gays, so that others can maintain a position of privilege. You said structures of power. You know, I was about to ask you, what is the purpose of dehumanization? You know, there's a lot of talk of, and so hold that in your mind for a minute, but I want to just give it a context. There's a lot of talk about identity politics versus class politics, at least on the left, you know.
Sure.
So class politics would say that racism, the function of racism is to divide and conquer, you know, the lower classes so that the ruling class can rule. But there's something that's not really totally satisfying about that description. And I wonder, so if you could talk about what is the function of dehumanization within the context of how society is structured around power.
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. That's a semester long of a discussion. But I think that what you raise is an important issue. One, I think that when we think about the function of dehumanization, part of it is to, first of all, part of it presupposes that we already have forms, as Judith Butler would say, we already have pre-picked those bodies that for which we can grieve and not grieve. So certain bodies are already grievable, and some bodies are already not grievable. Some bodies are already considered disposable, and some bodies are already considered non-disposable or essential. So I think that we have these categories that we've inherited, these stereotypes, this Procrustean, which means a very fixed way of thinking about the world, a myopic way of thinking about the world through the lens of race, through the lens of class, through the lens of sexuality and gender. And what happens is those bodies become the bodies that deserve to be dehumanized because they're already subhuman. So again, I think what we have to do then is critique the frameworks that are hegemonic, that are powerful, that are already in place systemically, and the ways in which those systems continue to function as sites of dehumanization, right? So the logic of dehumanization is predicated on this idea that the individual that is being dehumanized, first of all, is not quite human. So it's really a kind of a strange contradiction to dehumanize that which one already believes isn't quite human, right? But since we know they're human, since we know black people are human, since we know that trans and queer people are human, that women are human, it is dehumanization. But again, the logic of it is tied in with the idea that one group of people are, as it were, divine. They are part of a manifest destiny. They are part of, in the United States at least, a certain kind of American exceptionalism. It is their duty to rule the entire earth. I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois said, and I quote, he says that whiteness is this structure that is the ownership of the world forever and ever. Amen. That's kind of what he says, right? And regarding the question about class and race, you see, Du Bois also argued. He said that, look, we know that there are poor people in America. In fact, the philosopher Linda Alcoff actually says that her mother would pick cotton, poor, picking cotton next to black people picking cotton. But they were picking cotton in separate fields. They would not, despite their shared poverty, they would not mingle, right? So there's a way in which, as Du Bois says, even poor whites, even though they have that in common with poor blacks, they're not black. They're white. And so they continue to receive the privileges associated with whiteness, a certain kind of what he calls a psychological wage that they get. They get to feel more human. They get the protection of the police. There are ways in which they benefit precisely from that whiteness that gives them a certain kind of immunity. So I don't argue that race is a function of class. I don't take that traditional kind of, if you like, left Marxist kind of position. My argument is that racism is so structural that it is itself always already linked to class in a fundamental way, right?
Yes, but I think my point was more racism as a tool of the ruling class, you know, divide and conquer, just basically.
Sure. Yeah, okay, I got you. So yes, historically, race has, in the United States in particular, has been used precisely in that way, so that the bourgeoisie, the whites who were in power, precisely used the term black and white, terms black and white, as a way of dividing and conquering. In fact, there was a point at which there was this rebellion in the United States against those powerful white men, and it's called Bacon's Rebellion. And what happened afterward is that whites in power made sure that Bacon's Rebellion would never happen again, so they would not allow certain kinds of alliances to take place between enslaved blacks and poor whites, so they would eliminate that kind of solidarity. So I think historically that's exactly what happened in terms of class, the way in which race was manipulated to divide and conquer. But here's the problem. So many white people would rather have starved than to have identified with black people, right? So there's a way in which whiteness comes to substitute for food itself, right? As long as one is white, one is, as it were, replete. So even though it begins as a kind of top-down form of manipulation in creating divisions, it wasn't hard for those individuals who were in fact phenotypically white to identify with the ideology of whiteness. And part of identifying with the ideology of whiteness, and that includes the Italians who came to America, the Irish, and even Jews who came to America, they became white, which means they left their traditions, they changed, you know, their names in order to fit into the white supremacist structure. But in doing so, they too learned how to call black people by the N-word.
Dr. Yancey, so this is a very kind of, this is a very depressing prospect, because in a way, what you're saying is that it's a lot more complicated than, let's say, if I want to talk to other white people who are racist, saying to them, you know, this is against your own self-interest, because what you're pointing to is that there is almost a deeper need or a deeper hunger, maybe in a society which dehumanizes others, it dehumanizes itself.
Absolutely.
So that the only way people can feel like they're human is if they take on these artificial distinctions.
That's right.
Let's say. So you talk in this book, Backlash, not just about the hate that you and other black people have been subjected to, but also about love, where you were coming from. And I think you said that up at the beginning. So talk about love, about the sense of genuine relationality that you are calling for, and how we can leapfrog over these artificial divisions to a more authentic sense of humanity.
Yeah, sure. And I think that raises the question of my pedagogy. I mean, in my classrooms, for an example, I explain to my students that, you know, look, education comes from the Latin term educare, which means to lead out. And the beauty of that is the idea that one comes out from underneath, as it were, certain kinds of false assumptions, certain kinds of structural systems that in fact skew one's perception of the world. But this idea of being let out is also the idea of becoming vulnerable. Because to become vulnerable, etymologically, if you look at the origin of that word, it means to be wounded. And it seems to me that that's what I was trying to do in the letter, Dear White America. And we don't talk much about love, and love is not a sort of public discourse, and it certainly is not a public discourse under Donald Trump. And the kind of love I think that James Baldwin was talking about, he said that, look, it's not a Hollywood form of love, it's not sentimentality that I'm talking about when he says that. He says that it's the kind of love that is indicative of growth, which is a hard process, indicative of maturity, indicative of looking behind the masks that we use to deceive ourselves about our own identities and the ways in which we are caught up in systems of injustice that we fail to recognize. But that love is precisely this extending one's hand. You know, that's what I thought that Dear White America, the letter was. It was an extension of my hand. It was an opening up, what I call an unsuturing. It was laying myself bare, right? And that's a risk, right? It's an incredible risk, but that's precisely sort of the very core of love. Love is precisely taking a risk, right? And I don't think that, as Richard Wright would say, I don't think that America is prepared to engage in a national act of loving itself. I think its morality is too thin. I think it is spineless, it doesn't have enough courage, and it doesn't have a certain kind of ethical fortitude. So that I think that gesture of love, that giving that letter to White America, you know, showed me, demonstrated to me unequivocally that White America is not yet ready to have that serious discussion about racism in the name of love, which that means then, in the name of attempting to transcend one's identity that is currently limited, that is currently truncated in a certain kind of way, and literally reaching across the space that separates us, right? So as long as we conceive ourselves as neoliberal subjects, as atomic, as separate, as disinterested, right? Because that's how we're acculturated in this culture. But I want to argue that we need to rethink the ways in which we're already touching, that we're already haptic, and that's just a fancy word that means we're already embodiedly touching each other because we're part of a system. And if we know that we're touching already, then the question becomes, how do we want to touch, right? How do we rethink ways of touching? And if you look up the term neighbor, because I love etymologies, If you look at the term neighbor, it means to dwell near. But the problem is that in America, we're still living in a de facto segregated world, segregated spaces. So if we can't even begin to dwell near each other because we're de facto separated, right, or segregated. So this idea of dwelling near, to me, is this notion of putting oneself respectfully in spaces that where you're required to risk the very assumptions that you have. The idea is to begin to look at oneself through a disagreeable mirror, and that's what Baldwin says, right? So Dear White America, and by extension, my book Backlash, is a disagreeable mirror. It says, look at yourself. And as men, we too have to look at ourselves in disagreeable mirrors, the mirrors that women hold up to us. But if we're prepared to love, which is this robust and profound point of making oneself, this profound moment of making oneself vulnerable, to be open, to be wounded, to learn about oneself and to learn about the other, I mean, until we're able to do that, I think that we're just spiraling into the abyss. And that's what I see what's happening at the moment. And I don't see how we're going to get out of it.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with philosopher George Yancey about his book, Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. You know, what you say about being a neighbor, I went through a kind of evolution myself. My son, who is actually married to a Japanese woman, and his daughter, wife and daughter, they moved into Bedford-Stuyvesant, a neighborhood in New York City, which is historically black, but is now becoming gentrified. Now, they moved in before it was becoming gentrified because it's the only place they could afford to live. And I would, of course, go to visit them at the time. My granddaughter was 4, so she's 14 now. When I first started visiting them, you know, with all my, you know, dedication to racial justice, my father was a freedom writer, I mean, you know, the whole nine yards, I was scared, you know, because precisely what you say, this, I didn't grow up with black people. I imbibed into my bones the racist messages of my society. But as time went on and... it just became completely normal to me, and I changed the way I felt, and I changed the way I thought, and it just kind of fell away. It wasn't even that difficult. It wasn't even something that I had to, like, sternly talk myself into. It was just a simple act of familiarity that dissolved the boundaries.
Sure, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. We had a discussion in one of my classrooms where we were talking about racism and whiteness and relationships in terms of people dating. And so there was a moment where I had my students close their eyes and they had to imagine the significant other who was standing beside them right before they said, I do, right? And then they closed their eyes and I asked them to open their eyes and then describe the person next to them in terms of their quote-unquote race. And since I've been teaching at predominantly white institutions, there are generally more whites in my classrooms. And what happened was the vast majority of whites in the class said that the person standing next to them was white. And so we talked about that, and one of the students was uncomfortable by the implication, one of the white students, she was uncomfortable by the implication that I was suggesting that there's something racist about that. And so she said to me, and she was very, very stern about this in class, she says, Dr. Yancey, you seem to want to say that I'm racist because I will marry a white person. And I said, well, I'm not exactly saying that, but I want to talk about how you got to that place. So I asked her, and then she said to me, she says, look, I just don't desire black men. This is what she said to the class. And the other whites were sort of shaking their head. Yeah, that's a good point. But then I asked her, I forced her to answer this question, forced her in a very, very important pedagogical way. Where does desire come from? And so we began to explore what neighborhood she grew up in. She said she grew up in an all-white neighborhood. What school did you go to? An all-white school. So it was only then, and then I said, well, where do you think that desire comes from, or no desire for black men? And it was at that point that she was able to concede that something's problematic about her desires, right? Because she didn't see it before. She just took it as a given. But the problem is, if you're within, and this happens with the majority of my white students, they have not gone to school in 2018 with students of color. they haven't lived in those communities if they or with people of color, or maybe there's one black family. But here's a case where one is learning how to be white at the proverbial knee, right? One is learning what looks familiar, what one ought to identify with, the very possibility of loving someone who's black or someone who's Asian is completely closed off, because love is precisely that kind of, conjugal love is precisely being already shaped within this monochromatic community of whiteness. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that for the most part, we're so segregated and we don't raise questions about race and whiteness, certainly not within white communities. We don't talk about whiteness. I mean, black people, they have to have the talk with their children. I have the talk with my own black sons. I have to say to them, around a white police officer, don't move too quickly, because that can be interpreted as a furtive movement. Don't go for your ID too quickly, or don't even run. In other words, don't be a human being. Whereas white people don't have that talk, because they're not required to have that talk with their children, because they know that those police officers are there not to hurt them. In fact, there was a case, I don't know if you recall this, in Georgia, where a white woman was pulled over because she was drinking, and the white police officer pulled her over. She said, I'm sorry to the police officer. She says, I'm very nervous. I just don't want to be shot. And the police officer said, don't you know we shoot black people? He said that in order to calm her down, which to me is unconscionable, and which is just horrendous, right, to have said such a thing.
I can't call them if you don't open the door.
Why can't you?
Because I will not put my...
Use your phone. It's in your lap,
okay,
right there.
I just don't want to put my hands down. I'm really sorry. I'm just...
You're just wrong.
No. I've just been wasting many videos of problems.
But you're not black. Remember, we only kill black people. Yeah, we only kill black people, right?
But here it is. I mean, white folk are taught early on that it's the black body, is the body that is to be feared. And what we see this metastasizing at the highest points of government with Donald Trump's xenophobia, with his Islamophobia, with his anti-blackness, right? And anti-difference, quite frankly, where it's becoming the new norm in an unabashed way. It's as if the country is turning back to the old Jim Crow and the old Jane Crow, right, where whiteness is unabashed, where there's no censorship, right, where it's quite clear where you stand in terms of your political ideas, and we mustn't forget that, right? I mean, recently in Mississippi, a gentleman came in to vote with his Confederate flag and a noose around his neck. I mean, this is the world that we live in. This is the America that we live in, and I fear that we're spiraling out of control. I think this is one of the most dangerous moments in our history. I mean, I've spoken to people who are older than I, and they've said that the Cuban Missile Crisis doesn't even compare to this, right? So I think that if anything, if we're going to get the discourse of love going, we're going to have to create very powerful counter narratives. We're going to have to be able to create forms of new ways of seeing, of new ways of feeling, new ways of being affective, new ways of thinking about what it means to be human and what it means to be vulnerable and what it means to openly demonstrate public forms of love. But I think to do that, it can only happen within these very small communities where like-minded people are acting as gadflies, are acting as forms of consciousness that are able to prick the consciousness of one's own and conscience of one's own fellow, Americans, one's neighbors. Because I think that's where it has to begin, and perhaps it can metastasize into something like a movement. I mean, what would that look like? What would a movement look like in America that is itself predicated on love? I mean, I don't even know what that would look like.
It's interesting that you say that, because, reading your book, I was thinking, white people have to talk to white people about this. I mean, white people need to listen to black people, but talk to white people. But I don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
So one thing is, I want to ask you for some pointers, but there is an example. You know, there's maybe a lot of controversy over Bernie Sanders, but his campaign emphasized not me, but us. And it was always a multiracial us. You know, I mean, he was criticized for not talking about identity politics, but it was bred right into his politics that we are all together. And it emphasized love. And I think you've really got something there, that a movement is one that talks about what we share.
No, absolutely. And you know what's interesting? In fact, I would even go so far as to say that love, genuine acts of love, are also acts that recognize our difference. And that, you know, because if we're going to talk about what we have in common, we have to be careful that we don't overlook our differences. Otherwise, we conflate our differences. And then I'm not able to see how you, let's say as a white woman, experience male patriarchy, right? So it's important that I'm able to hear, able to be quiet, right? What I call fearless speech, or sorry, I call it both fearless speech and fearless and courageous listening. So fearless speech is this term, parhesia, P-A-R-R-H-E-S-I-A. And parhesia is a Greek term that means courageous or fearless speech. And the one who speaks it is the parhesiastes. Martin Luther King was one, Socrates, bell hooks, you name your figure, right? Bernie Sanders, right? But that difference we have to recognize, and so we have to learn how to listen courageously, which means knowing when to speak and when to be quiet. And I think that that's part of the lesson in learning about our fundamental differences. But being quiet is actually an empowering gesture. To be quiet is not to withdraw to the point of indifference. It is an active form of saying, I acknowledge you, and I acknowledge your integrity, and I also acknowledge that I could be wrong. So it's a very empowering gesture, quite frankly, but also there is that recognition of what we share, and I think that is so incredibly important. And I think that love does both, right? Love is able to recognize and appreciate our differences, but at the same time, finding out what that is that joins us together. What is that that touches us in such a way that it humanizes us as human beings as such, and the ways in which it humanizes us in terms of our own individual identities. But again, you know, I think it should begin in the home. I think that white parents have an obligation to talk to their white children about racism. So I often have a problem when white parents say to their white children that you're no better than people of color. I think that's a lie. And what do I mean by that? I know that white parents mean well by that. So for those who are listening, I'm not saying that you shouldn't say that, in the sense that we know that white children are not better than any other children in virtue of their whiteness. But here's part of the lie. When you tell your white children that, you set them up for a world in which they will refuse to recognize their own privilege. So even as you tell them that their whiteness doesn't make them any better, you also tell them about the history of whiteness. You tell them about how their whiteness will be excused by a police officer, that when they go for a bank, that whiteness will benefit them, that when they walk into a store, they will not be followed. When they get stopped by a police officer, they will know that they're not being stopped because or in virtue of their whiteness. So I think that's the truth we have to begin with. And we have to begin to tell our children the history. We have to tell them the history of whiteness and the history of people of color and the ways in which they're continued to be discriminated against and dehumanized and relegated to the margins of non-being. I think that's very important. And so it seems to me that if that love is to begin, that love has to begin with courageous conversations at the dinner table. So I tell my white students, I say, when you go home and you find yourself during Christmas break or Thanksgiving around a table where there are all white people, question your parents and ask them, why are there only white people sitting around this table? In other words, become a gadfly, become a conscience for your family to get them thinking about, how did we come to this point where we're only breaking bread with white people?
Yeah, and also what you're saying is we can't fall prey to the myth of post-racial society.
Absolutely.
That we need to celebrate the difference, acknowledge the history, and recognize our common humanity.
No, absolutely. And the problem with the post-racial discourse, it really exempts and lets white people off the proverbial hook from talking about racism and from talking about their own whiteness. Because if we're post-racial, then the only ones talking about race are black people and people of color, and hence we are the problem, right? But the myth of the post-racial is really a site of obfuscation and a way in which white people can avoid precisely talking about race. I mean, it would be like saying that we live in a post-sexist society, right? But that will let us men off the hook. And in fact, we would say, you know, women, why are you talking about sexism? We're beyond that. And it's like many white people have told me, you know, particularly during radio, you know, like radio, live radio shows, and a white person will come on and they'll say, you know, the problem with racism is that Dr. Yancey continues to talk about it. And I'm thinking, is that the solution? So you mean black people have been unaware all this time that it's because we have talked about it, that's why it continues to exist? And it's such an insult, because again, it would be like me saying to women, look, if you just stop talking about questions of economic inequality and forms of degradation, sexual objectification, they will go away, right? But that's such a horrible way of distorting history, and it's certainly a way of substituting fiction for facts, right? And so I think it's that courageous speech in the name of love that we need to engage in America.
Well, your book, Backlash, Dr. George Yancey, is a very huge step in that direction. I recommend it to all my listeners, and thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you. I very much appreciate it.
Dr. George Yancey. Go to writersvoice.net for links to both his 2015 New York Times op-ed, Dear White America, and his recent op-ed in The Times, hashtag I Am Sexist. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.